What's going on, Politoteen viewers? My name is Damien Galvin. Today we have a very special episode for you. We have Ted Terry. He's running for Super District 6, and it was a really good interview. We hope you guys do enjoy it. We kind of jump right into it, so definitely be sure to stick to the end. Me and Varun have our regular show, and we kind of bring in a little bit of what Ted said post-interview. We just hop right into a call, but the interview starts off at a random point, and it goes on from there. It's a really good interview. Be sure to stick it out. I highly recommend it, and happy listening. So I think our first, our initial question wants to be, obviously, as we have more guests on, what really got you into politics? What made you want to go down this path?
Well, if I'm going to be honest with you, I was dating a girl in high school, and I really liked her a lot. And she would invite me over to her grandparents' house for Sunday dinner, and her entire family would talk about politics and foreign affairs and what's happening with this policy and that policy. And I had no idea what they were talking about. So I just basically was like, well, crap, I need to, figure out what's going on. So I just started reading. And the more I read about foreign affairs and domestic policy and just all manner of things in the world, the more I was like, man, like, we need to get good people in office. So the true answer to your question is I got into politics because a girl.
That's awesome to hear. It's an interesting story. I love it. And I wanted to ask you one question personally. You were the mayor of Clarkston, and you made Clarkston into a place of acceptance for refugees and people like that. And I wanted to ask, in today's landscape of racial tensions in America, how can we make DeKalb County into a place of cultural acceptance?
Well, we absolutely have to, I believe, lead by example, and particularly Clarkston is where I've tried to lead by example. So Clarkston has, since I've been, over my mayoral term, partnered with Welcoming America, which is a national organization that is designed to help counties and city governments create actual policies within their administrations to be more accessible to immigrants and newcomers. And the great thing about creating policies that make your government more welcoming and accessible to immigrants, for instance, means you actually make it more welcoming and accessible for everybody. And so this is, I think, the opportunity we have in DeKalb. We're already a very, Clarkston's a very diverse town, but if you just take a 2-mile radius from Clarkston, you're in unincorporated DeKalb County, and it's as diverse as the city of Clark. So a lot has to do with just how the government interacts, when we're talking about business licensing, we're talking about how our police interact with non-English, English as a second language residents. Do our public health. There's so many things and layers that government works on that interacts with, ordinary people day to day. And so I think the first, again, is to make it a place that is accessible to immigrants, which will make it accessible to everybody. And the second piece of that, I think, has a lot to do with, this is going to sound corny, but it really is about bringing people together. And that's kind of a throwaway line in politics. In fact, right. My campaign card says, together we can move that forward. So it's very slogany, right? But what I mean by bringing people together, it literally means bringing people together. It literally means we have to step out of our comfort zone, and we have to go to places and interact with people and try to build relationships with people that we ordinarily wouldn't interact with if we just stuck to our normal routines. So we got to get out of our shells, out of our routines, and we got to explore. And every time I do a presentation and speaking on Clarkston, I always have a slide with a Mark Twain quote. And one of the quotes that I bring up is, he says that travel is fatal to bigotry, prejudice, and narrow-mindedness. And one cannot develop broad, wholesome views of the world by vegetating in one's own corner for one's entire life. And the bumper sticker is, travel is the only cure for ignorance. And I think that literally, in my mind, it literally means not necessarily traveling abroad, although that's encouraged, but traveling just outside, you know, your neighborhood, or traveling to a different school, traveling to a different, you know, festival or community organization. And so there's a lot of opportunities in that regard in DeKalb, because we have a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of the cultural events and festivals and just things that are happening all over DeKalb. But what I've noticed, and I noticed this in Clarkston, and I've noticed it in DeKalb as well, is that our community events, our cultural events, our religious events that are that take place throughout DeKalb year round, they're very segregated. It really is a lot of this, you know, very homogenous groups sticking to other people that are just like you. And we're going to have to challenge everyone to go to the Ramadan, you know, celebration.
Right, right.
We're going to have to challenge everyone to go to the Karen, you know, National, you know, Independence Day, Ethiopian, you know, New Year. I mean, there's all these amazing events and things that just happen in our county. And I had the privilege of going to all of them because I was the mayor. You know, I got invited to the Buddhist temple. I got invited to the mosque. I got invited to the Baptist, you know, so I got a chance to interact with people. And it's made me, I think, a more enlightened individual. I just have a better grasp because I've, you know, literally, you know, been in a situation where I get to meet people that I, you know, ordinarily wouldn't.
Yeah, well, obviously, this is a subject, you know, cultural diversity and inclusion. Inclusion and all stuff of that sorts is something that you're obviously very passionate about. And since being elected as mayor in Clarkston, it's been often referred to as the most diverse square mile in America and the Ellis Island of the South. Was this something that you were purposefully, you know, looking for to create this cultural diversity, or is it just something that happened over time?
So number one, Clarkston's been welcoming refugees since the 1980s. And so I can't personally take credit for Clarkston as a community being welcoming. I think that it's always been a welcoming place just from the people, right? When I get elected mayor, we had a campaign basically where the previous mayor had enacted a moratorium on refugee resettlement in the city. And so we had sort of a political divide where the leadership was saying, no more refugees. I was running for office saying, we need to bring people together. And when I got elected, we got rid of the moratorium, and Clarkston has since, you know, welcomed refugees. It went down during Donald Trump, of course. It went down everywhere. But we still had received refugees up until just, you know, COVID-19 and some of the kind of travel restrictions. But yeah, it's there was, I think, a need for the political leadership to align with where the public and the community was in part. And you know, that's why you have elections, right? I won with 52% of the vote. So it's not like I won in a landslide, but there was enough, a critical mass of individuals in Clarkston that were like, we need to change things.
And speaking of leadership, Ted, I wanted to ask, you know, climate change is a real threat. And you, as the former director of the Georgia chapter of the Sierra Club, know it more than anybody. So I wanted to ask, how can we in DeKalb work to curb climate change in our communities? You know, how can we make a greener community? And how do you plan to do so?
Yeah, so I've put out my DeKalb Green New Deal plan. It's not 100% match to a lot of the Green New Deals you see at the federal level. It's a more localized version. But it basically addresses the fact that climate change is real. Global warming is a threat, not just to us here, but to 100 million people living around the world who are at risk of becoming climate refugees. So climate change not only has the potential to disrupt our economies, but it actually will, you know, literally force hundred million people to have to leave their home because of flooding, because of, you know, literally they cannot live where they have lived their entire lives. So we've got to lead by example. It's not something that we can all do by ourselves to stop it, but if we all do it collectively, make a difference. And so what I've laid out in DeKalb is a pretty core principle, something the Sierra Club, when I was director, that we focused in on, and that's an equitable and just transition to a clean energy. And so what that means basically is, as we invest in energy efficiency, as we invest in electric vehicle, invest in solar energy, as we invest in diverting waste from landfills into composting, into recycling, as we design more productive urban landscapes instead of just mowing grasses and pouring chemicals, we have to make sure that the people that have been impacted the most by that environmental injustice and energy inequity are the ones who benefit first. And so a core principle of my DeKalb Green New Deal is investing very heavily in energy efficiency for fixed income or low income residents. And basically this is about addressing energy burden, which were in certain parts of Metro Atlanta, some people are paying upwards of 8 to 15% of their monthly salary just to keep the light.
Right.
Compare that to a newer, wealthier neighborhood in Metro Atlanta where someone's energy burden is like 2%. And so you can see there's a huge disparity just in how we pay for our energy and the fact that a lot of people who are already struggling because they don't make a lot of money, because they're retired seniors living on Social Security, they live in homes and apartments that are 40, 50 years old or more and haven't had the right insulation or the new light bulb or the new thermostat, all the new stuff that all the new homes have. So to answer your question very specifically, before we can do the big things like solar and wind and all like the clean energy, we need to actually use less energy. And we need to use less energy in the sense of we need to help people save money on their power bill. And so that's going to be probably my sole focus if I get elected to the county commission, is I want to spend the first 4 years really investing in energy efficiency, because it literally will help people who are making a minimum wage right now save up to potentially $2,000 annual just on their power bill. And $2,000 for someone who's on a fixed income or a low income is kind of a game changer when it comes to getting people out of poverty.
I'm really glad to hear it, because a lot of my friends on the right wing are saying, you know, a Green New Deal would hurt the economy more than help it and hurt people in poverty. But your plan seems to really, really help everybody out. So, you know, I commend you for that.
Thank you.
Obviously, your Green New Deal focuses on poverty. Do you have any other policies that really would help those that are suffering from a low income or are subject to a low income?
Well, you mean just like beyond environmental policies?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So everything, I think every part of my policy is rooted in equity and justice. So, you know, I want to expand early childhood education. I want to see a universal pre-K and 3K program for every DeKalb County, you know, child. Dollar per dollar, it has been shown that the best investment that we can make with our tax dollars is in the education of our young people, particularly getting them ready to go into, you know, public schools. Universal pre-K and 3K would literally save tens of thousands of families the huge expense of childcare and early childhood education. It's just one of those things that really separates people who have money and who don't have money. And so if we do that, I think that would be a huge benefit. It means that working families would, one, save thousands of dollars a year not paying for childcare. It would be more distributed across the entire county tax base. So everyone's benefiting from it, but the ones who are making the least amount of money would really benefit from it because, one, they're saving the money, they have someone watching their kids. And then long-term effect is that when children go into kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade, and they're at like grade level and they're ready to learn, graduation rates go up, dropout rates go down, test scores go up. And we all know that even in a 21st century economy, we've got to have as many high school diplomas as possible. It is a huge dividing line between poverty and not poverty. And then, you know, that kind of transitions even more so into actually getting admissions, which is proving even more so to be a divider in terms of whether you're going to live in poverty or that you're actually going to be able to live and provide for your families.
Absolutely. And, you know, one question I had for you from my stance is I've read your DeKalb For the People Act on your website, and I wanted to figure out what your stance was on corporate PAC money in politics, because I know a lot of politicians are taking a lot of PAC money. And I don't know how you feel about that. How do you feel about that, Ted?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Before I was running for a commission, I was running for Senate for about, you know, 7 months. And, you know, a big part of my pledge, and I think you're seeing this across the board with a lot of Democratic candidates, for instance, John Ossoff, you know, he's the Democratic nominee. We're all saying no corporate PACs. We're talking about, you know, $10 billion that corporations, lobbyists, and, you know, spend to influence our public level. Yeah, I'm for democratize as much of the campaign finances. The CAF for the People Act is actually creating a local public for candidates running for office.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, you know, you've been mentioning a lot of differences on the local level. What are some differences or some changes that you want to see be made on the federal level?
Oh, you mean on voting?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, well, the DeCab for the People Act is actually modeled after H.R. 1, which is the what the House Democrats' first bill they introduced back in 2019. So, yeah, it is more transparency. It's public financing. It's ending corporate control of our elections. It's actually funding our elections. You know, here in DeKalb County, they're still counting absentee votes. The Board of Elections are notoriously underfunded, understaffed, underpaid. And so we just need to actually treat elections as one of the most important things that we can do. Because if we don't have political participation, if we don't have faith in our democracy, then it corrupts the whole system, and inevitably it leads to what we're dealing with now, where we've had tens of thousands of people who are, and I'm one of them, marching on the streets for the end of police violence and police brutality and ending systemic racism. And I guarantee you the vast majority of those people voted for the first time last Tuesday. They have been politically disengaged, and they're political, but they're not political in the sense that they actually go vote and then volunteer or get other people to vote. And I think that's changing, because what's happening is, this has been said at protests, because I've been going to protests and rallies for two decades now. I figured it out way back during the Iraq War, when I was protesting the Iraq War, and we protested for two straight years to end the Iraq War, and then George W. Bush got reelected as president and continued the Iraq War and occupation. And so back then I was like, shit, we need to vote and to organize. And so I think that's what's happening now, is I think that people are saying, you got to vote, you got to organize. That's how we actually get good people in office.
Right. And on the topic of racial tensions in America, as you're talking about in your own segment, I wanted to mention how we're seeing deaths of people like Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and most recently, in Atlanta, I think we had another police death really, really, really recently. So I wanted to ask you, what is the solution to these crises and these police brutality instances? Is it regulations? Is it more acceptance? What is your solution to take on this crisis?
Yeah, it's absolutely a fundamental change in the way that we view public safety in America. I've been working and been in contact with commissioners in Athens who have introduced a 50-10 plan. Which so far in Georgia is the most detailed policy plan that's out there. Basically, what they're proposing in Athens, Clark County, is a 50% reduction of the police department budget over a 10-year period, a redirection of those funds that would go into the police department, putting it into social work, into public defenders, into healthcare and education. Basically, the things that we continually say, oh, if we just invest in these things, we'll have less of these things. And so one is just about how we generate our, you know, where we put our resources, number one.
Right.
And then the remainder of the police force, the response, for instance, to the police shooting in Atlanta, you know, we've seen this discussion carried out on social media, but also just, you know, in between individuals and my friends. But if someone's passed out in a Wendy's drive-thru, and, you know, if the solution is to call the police and to let someone else deal with it, then we've got to ask our question, you know, what can we do to help each other, number one? But two, like, if police are going to be involved, you know, if there's no call for an arrest or there's no violent incident happening, then we don't need to approach it as if we have to arrest every person that we see. Arresting and incarcerating individuals is ultimately a reductivist solution to a very complex problem. So yeah, the bottom line comes into how we, you know, what police, you know, are. I mean, a few things that I put forward in my criminal justice plan is we need to put more money into the Police Athletic League, which is an after-school program. It's an opportunity for police to be mentors and after school coaches, and to be a positive impact in, you know, young people's lives. Demilitarize the police. We don't need SWAT teams. We don't need tanks. We don't need rubber bullets. All of these things that police departments have, we don't really need them when it comes down to it, because the vast majority of incidences that police are dealing with end up really just requiring a social worker or some additional support. And so, you know, we got to be more multidisciplinary. In other countries, police officers have to go through 3 years of training. In Georgia, it's, you know, 16 months. So it comes with more training, diversifying the training. You know, I want to see an army of social workers out there, not an army of militarized police.
You know, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast here. I have a different view of defunding the police. You know, I personally haven't looked into it a ton as much as I assume you have. But, you know, I always bring up the fact that I think police should face more training and be trained more often and have a lot more training in general, but that they should also be paid more. I want to know your thoughts on that, on police pay.
Well, speaking from my experience as mayor, what I can tell you is one of the biggest challenges in police recruitment, and this has been over the last about 4 years, is that the smaller police departments like Clarkston can't afford, right? And I say can't afford, this is also while recognizing that almost 40% of Clarkston's budget is police and public safety. But other departments, Atlanta, Marta, Sandy Springs, they're paying officers $10,000 more annually starting pay compared to a city of Clarkston. And so there becomes like this, it's kind of an arms race in a way. It's sort of, you know, it's basically like the departments that can afford to pay the best kind of end up getting the, you know, I don't want to say the best officers, but they at least get the officers that are sort of, you know, probably have more experience and probably are better. And I think what ends up happening is some smaller departments either get left with a lot of rookies, and that goes back to your whole training issue. If we're putting a ton of rookies out there on the street who only have 16 months of training, you know, the possibility of something bad happen, you know, is probably increased. But then, like, if everyone is competing against each other, then you're sort of, it's going to be difficult to deal with this, you know, the quote defund paradigm, because a big part of those costs, necessarily militarized costs, they're actually just salaries and benefits, trying to keep pace with what sort of the going rate is. And so, for instance, in DeKalb County, what I would like to implement is basically something akin to a unified police system where City of Clarkston and Dunwoody and Pine Lake and DeKalb County, they're not all competing for the same pool of officers, but we're actually sort of sharing resources and we're sharing best practices and we're sharing sort of the policies that we really want to see put in place, which are the policies that, you know, are being discussed at the Capitol right now, de-escalation training, ending chokeholds, training officers that pulling a gun is not the first response. It is absolutely the last response. And there has to be all of these internal changes, and then you got to get internal changes adopted countywide at school policing, at MARTA policing, at DeKalb policing, at all the municipal policing, at all the college policing. You know, I just named six police departments, six types of police departments that exist in DeKalb County, and we all operate on our own systems, our own employee handbooks, our own pay schedules. I mean, it's a very complicated system. And I, you know, my solution right now is to create a civilian-led policing model where the police are more directly working for the people that they're supposed to protect, right?
Absolutely. I think what Damien and I usually talk about on our podcast is how the social construct has been broken between police and the people, and we need to repair that social construct through more community and people inclusion. And I guess we're nearing the end of our segment today, Ted, but I wanted to ask you upon our previous questions, the LGBTQ community. You know, you've been a big advocate for LGBTQ rights in our nation and Clarkston County. I wanted to ask, you know, where does the answer lie in acceptance for this community? Is it through legislation? Is it through community reform? What is your answer to increasing acceptance for the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think that it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about travel being the only cure for ignorance, I am reminded of the cultural phenomenon of the sitcom Ellen, like 25 right. years ago. And I was catching another podcast, Love It or Leave It. And it was literally just talking about this. It was talking to young LGBT listeners, and they were, kind of complaining about how the gay characters in this show that I watch, they're not as complex characters. Whereas John Lovett was saying, well, shoot, like 20 years ago, I was just hoping for just one character who was gay. Right. And so right. I think the culture in America has certainly, and, you know, for the most part, the Western civilization has shifted so much towards the acceptance of LGBTQ, transgender, and even more specifically in transgender. And it's kind of just like it's creating a space, I think, for us to separate ignorance from bigotry, because I think a lot of issues that I've seen over the years in regards to lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, it's more ignorant as opposed to bigotry. And how do you cure ignorance? Well, you have to create the space where people can ask the questions and learn and evolve. The people who are the bigots, you know, we just have to not tolerate it. We have to say that this kind of behavior is not acceptable in our society. But we got to tackle ignorance. We don't want to confuse ignorance with bigotry. We want to recognize that a lot of people just don't know what they don't know. And we have to be persistent and consistent with pushing, this vision of an equal, of a world that has equality, where we treat everyone with respect and dignity. And then we don't have tolerance for narrow-mindedness, prejudice, bigotry, racism.
Interesting how you bring up the point, you know, where you kind of solve these issues through discussion and through inclusion, and especially the point of ignorance, where you kind of, the way that you get rid of it is really by creating this discussion. And that's kind of what we focus here on Politeen. We want to create discussion in our youth in order to hopefully have the next generation be more inclusive. And we think that it all starts with the discussion and particularly political discussion. So our final question to you here would be, if you had one thing that you could leave to the youth, you know, one saying, one thing that they could remember you for, what would it be?
Well, here, this is my new way of life right now, is focused on talking to as many people, whether it's face to face or, you know, 6 feet away, as possible. And, you know, personal connections as opposed to social media connections. And I really believe, and this is my just experience of working in politics and being in office for the last, you know, 6.5 years, but I can without a doubt 100% say that I have accomplished more by working with people one-on-one and talking to people like where they're at, as opposed to arguing with someone on social media. So I can just tell you right now that if you want to change the world, it won't happen on social media. It's going to happen by getting out there in the world and actually making those changes. And I know that's a really hard thing to say to a lot of people, because we know that social media is designed to make people addicted. So I'm not telling people you have to go cold turkey, but I don't want anyone to think that just by being a social media warrior that you're going to solve racism, that you're going to solve discrimination. The only way we're going to solve it, the only way we're going to tackle it, is you got to go out there and talk to people face to face.
It's a powerful message, and I'm glad we mentioned it today, that you mentioned it. And you know, it's 1:30. Our interview is finished with Ted Terry, and we're glad to have you on the show today. It was an amazing segment that we had, and you know, I had fun. It was an awesome experience. Thank you so much, Ted.
Yeah, thank y'all so much. Appreciate it.
All right. All right. So yeah, we just got out of the interview with Ted Terry here, and me and Varun, we hopped on, and the first thing we said that was good. That was a really good interview, Varun. And the thing that I'm really happy about was that he kind of goes with our message. You know, as we were asking him questions about how you can solve these cultural issues and issues with cultural inclusion, his like message was to go out and talk to people. And I think that that's really good, and that's really powerful, and that kind of correlates with our message here at Politatine.
I agree as well. I think Ted Terry was a very, very knowledgeable person and a very good person to have on our podcast, Damian. And I wanted to talk about many things that he brought up today. He really enlightened my knowledge about certain social issues and how to solve social issues, as he presented so many solutions that I never thought about, especially the 50-10 rule in this policy in defunding the police. How did you feel about how Ted mentioned that kind of policy that many counties are following after, you know, decreasing police funding by 50% within 10 years and a gradual slope?
Yeah, no, I think that it's a really good idea. I think that obviously, if we had more time, you know, I'd definitely like to go into that, because that's a very interesting policy. And I think that, you know, it's good that he's just not taking away the funds. I think it's good that he knows exactly where those funds are going to go over the next 10 years. And, you know, they're going to go into to these different programs that he already has in mind. And I think that's wonderful. You know, as once you left, I told him that it was great to have him on the podcast. I was still recording there. So I think our viewers heard that. But I told him that it was great to have him on the podcast. And he told me that it was wonderful to have him on. And I told him that we should have him on again sometime. And he said, hopefully that once he wins, he would love to come. He would love to come back on, and that we should keep him posted. But I definitely, if there's a next time, I definitely want to ask him about how that 50-10 program is going.
Absolutely. And I think I'm excited to see if he does win the election, how he plans to implement the programs that he told us about into DeKalb County. It's going to be an interesting few years for DeKalb County under Ted Terry as Super 6 Commissioner if he does win the election. But going on to our podcast today, Damian, I wanted to start off our podcast on a very, very disturbing note. You know, we saw the instance, the most recent police shooting of Rayshard Brooks, who was shot dead by a cop in front of a Wendy's in Atlanta. And it sparked outrage in our community, in our nation, about how police brutality is still happening amidst the protests that are happening today. So I don't know if you saw the video yourself, Damian, but I watched a video online, and it's disturbing. We saw a police officer, I feel like, unnecessarily shoot Rayshard Brooks in the back. And it was very disturbing and a bad message that I saw from our community. I guess, how do you feel about Rayshard Brooks and how he was dealt with?
You could hear me, but the podcast couldn't hear the background noise that was going on. I think that it was honestly a very big tragedy. I think that it was... You know, it's one of the most more questionable situations. Unfortunately, you know, it leaves a lot of questions. It leaves, I guess what I'm trying to say here is, it leaves more questions as onto whether it was justified, because, you know, the instance was he was armed, he was running away with a taser, and obviously a taser can be used as a lethal weapon. But I think that the thing was that he was running away, you know, at the end of the day, he was running away. And before we hopped on the interview with Ted Terry, I was talking to you about how people were saying that, oh, what did you want the police to do? Let him run away? And my answer was yes. I think that there's a lot of circumstances where you have, you know, the call wasn't like a hostage situation where this guy was keeping three people inside of the Wendy's at gunpoint. It was a call where there was a drunk guy passed out, and he started to run away with a police taser, and it's just like, okay, let him go. He's not posing a threat to society, a significant threat in my eyes. And I think that you know, the kind of use of lethal weapons needs to be limited to circumstances where you have those hostage situations. You know, I have this idea, and I want to kind of propose it to you, where with routine pullovers, you know, where you're stopping someone, that you don't even bring your weapon with you, because honestly, I think that it can just be used to escalate a situation. Obviously, I know that it can be dangerous to certain officers if you don't have that weapon on you. But I think how would you feel if police didn't carry the weapon in routine pullovers?
great kind of investment for our police forces to invest in non-lethal ways of de-escalating a situation instead of always having lethal force as a first option, as we did see in the Rayshard Brooks incident. I think you bring up a very great point, Damien, how police officers are often looking at lethal force as a first option when obviously it should be a last option. You know, because it can kill people. It can really, really hurt our nation and our communities in a very, very bad fashion. So I think that you're right in that scenario. I think we should invest in more non-lethal force. Make sure the police officers, I don't know if the solution necessarily is taking out lethal force from the entire equation, but I think we should invest in making them know that last option is lethal force. This should not be something they should be using on a constant basis or even thinking about. You know, it should be something that they should consider and say, what are the ramifications of my actions? Police officers should say, I am also accountable to my people, and I should be able to be held accountable as a police officer. Upon your point, I think the solution may be limiting the usage of lethal weapons. It also should be in holding accountability for our police officers on the legal level, making sure law enforcement is held accountable for their actions. Also saying, you know, and training these people to say lethal force is not a first option. It is a last option, a fifth option.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, you were talking about lethal force being the last option. And Ted Terry brought up the fact that he didn't want to have a SWAT team. And I thought that was interesting. I never heard about that. But, you know, I guess you have to think about how practical a SWAT team is. And I've never been in an instance where I see like the SWAT team truck really engaged in a situation where I would think like this is actually what a SWAT team is used for. So I want to know your thoughts on that. Like what do you think about taking away a SWAT team?
I think, Damien, that the SWAT teams are often a scary reality for many communities. I think that a lot of people are scared of these SWAT teams because of what their capabilities are in our communities. I think that Ted brings up a very, very good point. I think it would create more of a community sense if we disband these SWAT teams and invest that money we were putting into these SWAT teams towards community enhancement forces, social workers, as Ted mentioned, and also things where police officers can act as mentors for our community, help out with community causes. So I think that SWAT teams sometimes in more less organized cities are a unnecessary use of money. I think that the money that we put into these facilities can be reinvested in our communities and our people. I agree on that standpoint. I think we should dissolve these forces and reinvest that money, from my perspective.
Yeah, sorry, I'm chewing here. I'm literally just, you know, we always try to be upfront with our viewers. I'm having like my first meal of the day right now. I just got out here. We had the last episode where we were filming out of the back of my car, and I came over here to have better connection. So that's why there might be some background noise here. I'm trying to get in my first meal of the day, but no, I think that it's a very interesting point. I think that I haven't looked at it in that perspective, and I would have to look into the practical use of these SWAT teams, but. Ted brought up a lot of interesting points, and I'm happy about his social issues. And he seemed very humble, obviously, when I brought up the question about the most diverse square mile in America. You know, he seemed very humble about his answer there. It was a really powerful interview, and obviously his last powerful statement. Do you have anything that you wish like you could have asked him there?
I think I wanted to ask him a little bit about how Clarkston became the city it was. Because he was very humble about it. You know, he said that he didn't do much to increase the amount of acceptance that Clarkston had. We're looking at Clarkston being a national model and an international model for refugee acceptance and awareness. We saw Ted Terry go to a UN council meeting and talk about how Clarkston really made moves, influenced the political stage and the refugee stage. So I wanted to ask him how he made Clarkston into the city that it was. You know, he did play a big role in making Clarkston a community of awareness. I think that the Clarkston model is something we should all take in all of our cities, because it's not just refugee acceptance that we're having an issue with in our nation. I mean, it is racial acceptance. It is acceptance of LGBTQ people. I think that following in that mission, and he talked a lot about leading by example. I wanted to ask him more about how leading by example has worked with him in specific instances. Because I think we all need to follow in that example, in that quote. Leading by example is something we'd all need to discuss and to implement within our own lives, especially with regard to racial tensions and LGBTQ rights and things like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, I wish that I could have asked him more questions about the federal level, but I wasn't too sure if he would want to have answered those particularly right now. But yeah, no, I definitely would have had some questions about his about the leadership of Donald Trump and stuff like that. But I mean, he just seems like a very genuine guy. I hope that the podcast viewers could tell we could see the way that he was talking live. You weren't able to see that on the podcast, but I mean, he seemed very genuine in his answers and his responses, and you could tell he was thinking things out. I think that was a great interview. Obviously, he talked about LGBTQ rights, and how the perception of inclusion has been different over the years. How do you expect that to change? Because if you don't know what I'm talking about here, you know, he said 20 years ago it was just enough to have just a gay person on a show, but now people want a gay person with extreme characters that represents everyone. How do you think that companies are kind of gonna adjust to all the different needs of inclusion, if you get what I'm saying here?
I wanted to bring up a point upon that point and what he said, and I'm kind of going to digress from what you asked me, and I'm going to go back to what you said. I've seen a lot of my friends and been talking about gay characters in TV shows and movies. They've been saying, you know, I don't like how companies are including these gay characters because they don't have a personality. You know, they're simply sitting there and they have no personality, and their only purpose on the show is to represent that gay community. And I think I don't agree with that, and I think that we need to address that issue head on, because a lot of people are kind of dissing the gay community based upon these presences in TV shows. And I think that, you know, more than these characters being gay, we need to understand that these are also characters. These are human beings, and it's not about you know, their role as being gay, but it is about their overall character on the TV show. I think that we're expecting more out of these characters because they're gay, and we're saying, you know, what would it be like if this character was straight? And yeah, that was just something I wanted to air out, my confusion and grievances over those kinds of instances. Upon your previous point, I think corporations are having a big role in promoting LGBTQ rights, as they should be doing.
Yeah.
As you're saying, we're seeing many movie corporations and TV show corporations pushing forth the LGBTQ community and increasing awareness, and that is where it lies. We need to blur the line between gay people and straight people, and we need to blur that line and say we're all humans. As we always mention, you know, we're all Americans. We're all human beings. We shouldn't differentiate that much between sexuality lines. I think including people in TV shows and movies is a first step towards a very bright future.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that it doesn't just stop necessarily with gay people. You know, we talked about gay people, and we talk about how gay people are represented in community or in movies and stuff. But I think that also African Americans and Latino males are represented like in a more negative light in movies and stuff. You know, you have the cholo, which is typically being played by a Hispanic male in a lot of these movies, and outside of that, you don't really have a character for them or in a in movies where you have a lead role for an African American, it's usually something to do with drugs or crime of some sorts. And so it's interesting to see how maybe we're going to proceed forward, not only with, you know, LGBTQ rights, but also with racial rights, and how we're going to have more racial representation.
Absolutely. I think that it goes on to say that corporations need to take focus even more than they're doing already, and to show people that it is okay to be gay, it is okay to be black, it is okay to be any race that you are. We should learn to accept everybody as human beings. And I think that the Supreme Court earlier today released a overall briefing and a legislation rule that allowed that made sure that all employers could not discriminate based upon LGBTQ status of people and sexuality. I think that it goes to show that beyond corporations, we on a national level have to make moves, force corporations to be more inclusive, because sometimes we're seeing many corporations such as Brandon Melville, as we talked about earlier in our previous segments, and Urban Outfitters discriminate based upon race and sexuality. I think it comes down to the buck stops at the national level. We need to raise awareness for these things and increase corporate acceptance in terms of employment legislation first. That should be our first policy of reform. And I love how the Supreme Court is doing that. And they released that statement today. It brought a lot of joy to my heart and to millions of Americans as part of that community, joy to their hearts, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that it's an important discussion. And, this is something that I wanted to bring up with you just now that I thought about. We're having this discussion, obviously, and you see me mention, pre-show, hey, we need to ask Ted this, or we need to ask Will this, or we need to bring up this, mainly because, or especially because, I say, not mainly, but especially because it's Pride Month. So I want to know, how can we keep these discussions going? You have this a lot in February with African-American history and stuff like that. You have these issues being discussed. How can we keep this going beyond the month? How can you keep the discussion of inclusion going beyond just this month?
You know what? I think that what you're saying, it really relates to how we're talking about racial tensions. We've seen a spike in discussion about racial tensions just in this month because of the shooting of Arbery earlier in the year, George Floyd, obviously, and most recently, Rashard Brooks. I think that the discussion is kept going, Damian, by people constantly bringing up the issues that we're facing as Americans and the issues that we have been facing. Because the police deaths that we've encountered in months past and years past have been tended to be forgotten. We're seeing a lot of people forget the death of Breonna Taylor, of many other people who have been killed by police brutality. We're only starting to recognize these cases again and remember these cases because more instances of police brutality are happening now. I think that the discussion is kept going by remembering those affected by issues along LGBTQ rights lines, along racial lines. It's kept going by remembering their sacrifices and their deaths to better America. Now, as we remember MLK every single day, we remember MLK for racial justice. We should continue to remember Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and the countless other names in racial tensions. Continue to remember many, many other names in the LGBTQ community that helped advance this fight. I think identifying those idols is the way to move forward. I honestly, personally, I've had a friend, he goes to my school, and he goes to going on his private story on Snap, a personal story, and talking about how there's been many, many, many idols, whether it's Ellen or anybody else, advance the LGBTQ community, and he himself is a gay American. I think that doing things like these and identifying your idols is the first step towards greater cultural inclusivity and greater sexuality inclusivity and things like that, and that's my stance, Damian.
Yeah, no, for sure. You want to be careful there because you just kind of DDoSed us by saying the school name, so maybe in the post we can take that out.
Right.
What I was gonna say here is, it's such an interesting thing because we're talking about how these things get forgotten, and obviously we live in a culture. Obviously, we're a very cultural based show, but we live in a culture where everything is very fast moving and fast based, and things happen and then they're forgotten, and then the next thing comes up and people are angry about that, and you have three people being canceled on the same day, then the next day everyone forgives them. And I talked about on my ignorance segment, the solo segment that I did on my YouTube channel, I talked about the fact that I thought that this discussion, this level of anger, this level of discourse, this preposition of change would have happened after Emmett Till. And then, you think again that it would happen after Rodney King, and then again after Trayvon Martin, and you keep having this happen, and again it just dies out, and people suppress it, and it dies out, and I want it to keep happening, and I don't want us to just move on a stance. I think that a big problem is, as Sateri was mentioning, social media, that a lot of people try bringing change on social media, but the conversation evolves too quickly on social media. I think that these are conversations that we need to have, in real life, and that we need to get to the bottom of. So what are your thoughts with what I'm saying here?
I think I was going to say something very similar. I mean, because social media is not always the perfect way to raise awareness about social issues. I think we should all, as Americans, have these conversations that we're having right now. try to raise awareness on a nationwide level. I think a lot of teams should follow in our footsteps, Damien, and try to have political conversations of their own, as we talk about to end every single podcast. But
I agree, you know, the best role models for sure.
No, I don't think I meant it in that way specifically, but obviously
I meant it in that way.
You know, I think that upon your previous point, I think that schools especially should start to have political conversations, because a lot of political conversations in schools today and in other club-based scenarios are suppressed. Because we need to have more of these conversations on a school-wide level and on an institutional level to encourage the amount of awareness that we do have. I think that is the first step to stopping these kinds of discrimination in our nation today. And we're talking about many issues in terms of social media and how social media has influenced the race towards getting equality in racial tensions. And how do you feel about Twitter being a really, really good platform for people to follow up on social media trends, to label their points of view? Very avid users of Twitter, and the original goal of this podcast was to be a social media platform and to encourage social media discourse. How do you feel about how Twitter has encouraged that fight?
You know, I think that Twitter's done a good thing by allowing different people's voices to be heard. I can't discourage what Twitter's doing. I mean, obviously they're doing their best as a social media platform, and obviously you see them trying to do beyond their best and trying to do their better by what some might consider censoring the president, or what I would consider is informing the public that there's different points of view to everything. So I think that Twitter's trying to do their best, but again, you have 240 characters. You have a base that's moving very quickly. You know, one day one thing can be trending, and the next day, I mean, one day one thing is trending, and then the next day it just falls off and you completely forget about it, and you go to follow up on the hashtag and see what else is happening on that hashtag. And that very second, you know, it's gone. And so you're moving on to the next thing right away. I think that what needs to happen is what Ted was saying, where you need to go out and have discussions, even if they are discussions like we're having here. Because with a discussion, you can get a sense for the other person's sincerity. I think that, you know, when you're texting and stuff, I have, as we started doing the podcast, I don't know if you found yourself doing this, but I've enjoyed phone calls more. And I don't know if it's because of the podcast or it's just a correlation with it. But I think that phone calls are easier. I think that you can get your sincerity across. You know, typically with my girlfriend, we would text all day and all night. And obviously, you know, now I think phone calls are really – they feel a lot more natural, especially because of the coronavirus thing. And you have appreciation for the other person's voice and the sincerity that you can hear with them and the different tones that they're taking. So I think that we need to kind of move to maybe a platform like that where you can really have – discussion. And I think that you know, things like Zoom gaining popularity are a good thing. I don't know necessarily what the answer is, but I think Twitter's trying their best, but again, it's a speech thing.
Absolutely. And I think you brought up a really great point there, Damien, because as Ted mentioned in his interview, his last point for our teen population was to get off social media and texting and things like that, and start to have real conversations. And you know, we can't have these kinds of conversations in person as much because of the coronavirus, obviously. But I think the next best thing, Damien, as you mentioned, is having phone calls and having FaceTime calls. I think that, you know, it's important for us as people to have more conversations and to create more lasting connections, because that is how we prosper as a people. And that is the gateway to more political conversations and more political kind of discussion. Because upon my point, my earlier point about the LGBTQ community, I'm a strong believer the way to acceptance in this community is to have more conversations with gay people, with people of different sexualities. Because before last year, I wasn't so sure about my standpoint. I hate to say this, but the car and things like that, a lot of times I would make really, really, really insensitive joke about the gay community. But after, and right now I have a lot of gay friends that I talk to on a daily basis, and I think having these conversations with these people has told me a lot of my gay friends are the most genuine friends and the most funny friends that I have in my life. And having these conversations has inspired me to accept that community more so. I think that is the first step having acceptance in America. It is having these conversations with people who you haven't been kind of exposed to. And as we talked about on our previous podcast, you know, I think I forgot what his name was, but a commentator, a podcaster that you were mentioning, Damien, had a bunch of conversations with KKK people. And these KKK people, they kind of opened up their mindsets because they talked to this black person and they understood that black people aren't the kind of bad people that they were taught that they were for so long. You know, they're a human being. We should learn to accept them through having conversations in person and over FaceTime. Like,
yeah, no. Well, you were talking about how the fact that obviously you made insensitive jokes, and I still make insensitive jokes to this day, and I make insensitive jokes, you know, or what might be considered insensitive jokes, around, you know, I'll make gay jokes around gay people, but you have to understand that again, you have to understand the level of comfort that you have with these people. You know, you don't want to be having these conversations where everything's PC and you're going out and you're talking like a news anchor and you're having these fake conversations. You know, I think obviously I've had Hispanic jokes made at me, and I've shared my jokes back. But I think that that's part of being able to laugh at yourself, and being able to laugh is part of acceptance, and that's something that I've always believed. Obviously, you know, I wouldn't go out and say something derogatory or deflammatory on social media. I don't think that's right. But obviously, you need to know the type of people that you're having a conversation with, and I think that that goes back to, you know, what you're saying on Twitter. You might think what you're saying on Twitter is funny, but some people might find it offensive, and you know, that's where I was talking about the whole Jake Frum thing, where it's like, you know, what you're saying to one person, you might think, hey, you know, I'm just having a conversation with this person, just getting my thoughts across, and other people might find it offensive. So I think that, you know, you need to know who you're talking to. You need to know the type of conversation that you're having. You need to know the type of conversation that you're having, obviously, and then you need to know how you can proceed with that conversation, and whether you can make jokes, and whether you can... you know, I think that sharing a laugh is a good thing, but you need to know again what you're talking about and who you're talking to.
I think it is the first step towards acceptance beyond racial boundaries, beyond sexuality related boundaries. It is a interesting first step, and I like how we both mentioned that point. But I do want to mention, Damien, as a last point to our podcast today. You know, we've been talking so much over the past couple of days about protests and how the black community has been killed and injured by police officers for so long. And I think that our last point today should be, I was looking at on Real Clear Politics about some instances in which police officers have been injured during protests. And a Metro officer named Shay Michelonis has been paralyzed from the neck down because somebody shot him during a protest in his home city. So I think we should both talk about a very disturbing fact that has been going on in today's world. How do we deal with protesters being able to be violent against these police officers who really haven't done anything specifically in that instance? How do we go along with raising awareness for that? Because I heard about that over today. That happened so long ago, and there's been no news coverage for that. I think that that's also a problem we should be facing. How do you feel about that, Damien?
Well, I think that it goes, you know, I think that, you know, obviously I like making jokes, and that's something that the podcast audience is going to get. So eventually as they go on listening here, but, you know, I think that I always have the best takes. I'm going to be honest. And I think that my takes always stand true the test of time. And it's the same take that I had for how do you de-escalate the rioters. You know, the way that you stop the rioters is by bringing in police to protest with them, not police protesting against them and trying to stop them. The way that you stop people assaulting police officers is to throw the police officer in the crowd and tell them, I'm here with you, brother. I understand your pain. I understand the agony that you're feeling. I want to make change too. How can we do this together? Let's march. Let's walk. Let's talk. Let's have conversation. But obviously, you're going to have some police officers shot when the police officers telling someone to, you know, back the F off and get away, go away, get down. And you're telling them, stop protesting. You're going to have you're going to have the resorts to violence more often if you're escalating a situation as opposed to de-escalating it. And obviously I was making a joke about my takes, you know, always standing the test of time and being the overall best takes. But I think that this is one that stands strong, and this is one that I really have. Obviously I like listening to different points of views, but I think that honestly the best way to proceed forward with the situation that we're facing in America is for all of us to come together and tell each other, I understand your pain, I understand your suffering, tell me what I can do. Let's have a conversation. How can I help? How have I wronged you? Let's get this fixed. Let's get this resolved. What are your thoughts on what I'm saying here?
I think whether you're white, whether you're brown, whether you're Latino, and whether you're black, whether you're any other race or sexuality, I think we should all come together and say, I stand with the black community, because the issues that we're facing today are bigger than anything that we've faced the past year. It is a disturbing fact that we're seeing many, many black people being discriminated against by the police community. And I don't agree with it whatsoever. I think we should all stand together against police brutality. But upon your previous point about police kneeling and standing with protesters in today's world, I think that is a good thing, you know, to do. But we're seeing a lot of problems. And for example, with the Buffalo Police Department, same police officers which pushed over a 72-year-old white man who was returning a police helmet previous couple of days, kneeled with protesters to show their solidarity. I think that when you're creating this contrast between the same police officers, you're actually, you know, kind of making trust go down, creating more trust issues. I think that it is important for police officers not only to kneel with protesters as a sign of solidarity, but to also support protesters as a sign of solidarity, and not kind of go against their own previous action, doing things like pushing over that 72-year-old. But it is 2:03 p.m. Over in Atlanta, and I think we should, you know, end today's podcast on a similar note as our previous podcasts. We're almost at 1 hour here. I don't know if we're over 1 hour. But as always, as Damian usually says in our podcast, you know, go home, have conversations with your families, and spark political conversations and discourse between your peeps.
Yeah,
for sure. So it's always important. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. You just cut out, so I thought you were done talking. Go ahead.
Of course, always, you know, encourage people to research and do their research and educate themselves about social issues, social change today. So that's my ending point on the Politi team.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, if you got to do what Ted did and go get a girl that's politically active to get you engaged, you know, go ahead and do that. Go ahead and get a girlfriend that's politically active and join the discussion at the dinner table with her. I think that was a great story. I want to apologize first off for any background noise or anything. Obviously, you know, we're trying to get everything situated and trying to still bring episodes to you guys as we travel. I'm really happy to be bringing episodes to you guys. It's something that I definitely look forward to. But as Varun was saying, and as I was saying, by getting a girlfriend, go out there and have a political discussion. But beyond that, guys, we want to thank you for tuning into this very special episode with Ted Terry. We hope you guys did enjoy it, and we hope that you guys do tune in this Friday as well, as we will be bringing on another very special guest.
Yup, we'll have Krista Olenzak, a candidate for Georgia House District 26, jump on our podcast and talk about her campaign, which is ongoing, and also talk about the issues that she's wanting to face in specific education, climate change, and LGBTQ reform.
Yep.
For this podcast, that's our last ending point. And thank you so much for joining. Make sure to follow our Twitter, Politi-teen Show. And as always, peace out from the Politi-teen family.
Goodbye, guys.
Hello, everybody. It is June 15th, 2020, and this is Varun coming at you. As always, make sure to follow our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, any platforms that you kind of use to subscribe to podcasts. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politi-teen Show for any and all updates for Damian and myself. Just a couple of updates for you guys, our fan base. We are going to be having Krista Olenzak, a candidate for the Georgia House District 26, come on our podcast this Friday to discuss her policy and certain issues that she feels very strongly about for our state. And that said, make sure to, you know, spark political conversation with your peers and fellow Americans, and enjoy your Mondays. Thank you guys so much for your viewership.